The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
All right, we are back with a pretty tight schedule tonight, but we'll see if we can't jump a caller here or two for Jonathan Benz. His new book is called The Recovery-Minded Church, Loving and Ministering to People with Addiction, newly released, by the way, by InterVarsity Press. You can get it at bookstores around the Bay Area, of course, through therecoveryplace.com. Jonathan, let's talk some specifics. When we talk about ways in which the church can do a better job, aside from simply saying, let's open up the church basement and allow AA to hold meetings there, what, from your perspective, do you think the body of Christ can be doing that will create the kind of environment that will allow addicts to feel welcome, number one, inside the church? And then what kind of tools do we need to be equipped with in order to really adequately and appropriately minister to them?
I think education is a great place to start. If there are, for example, lay leaders in the congregation who have this kind of passion, or who have a particular compassion for people struggling with some kind of addiction, just getting good information and changing the tenor of the conversation within the spiritual community helps. I think being clear that in saying and intentional in our message and saying, hey, we want you here. We don't have all the answers, but we're going to help you find the answers that you need. And we're going to journey with you and be on this journey with you to find what you're looking for. And if we can't find it here, we're going to help you find it somewhere. I think that's what a lot of people are looking for who are struggling with addiction. They don't know where to go. And so there are even practical things that congregations can do. One of the most practical things I say is have a list in your foyer or in your lobby of your church that is a list of community resources, not just numbers for the AA intergroup, but also therapists that you work with or believe in, or treatment centers, or different options, so that people can know that they don't have to do this on their own. Oftentimes the best thing we can do is point them in the right direction if we don't have the answer.
And, of course, the irony is, based on just some of the broad definitions that you've shared with us tonight, I think many pastors would maybe be surprised to find out that many of these so-called addicts are sitting in the church pews right now. Now, this may not be the guy that has, you know, the mainline heroin addiction or is diving into a bottle of vodka every night, perhaps not at the extremes, but there's all kinds of signs of addictive behavior that can have negative consequences on certainly your spiritual health, your relationships with your spouse, your children, etc. So it would seem to me, when you talk about 30% of Americans that deal with one degree of addiction or another, that a good percentage of them are already in the pews, and this kind of addictive behavior years going unaddressed.
But, you know, what about the woman who can't go to sleep at night without her 2-milligram Xanax, which on the streets is called a Xanny bar? But if you get it from the pharmacist, it's called a 2-milligram tablet of Xanax. Or the man who has to take his oxycodone to get to work and has to take it throughout the day because of his car wreck, and he can't function without the painkillers. These are very powerful narcotics that our doctors prescribe, and oftentimes we have people sitting in our pews who have become dependent on these medications, these narcotic medications, and can't get off and don't know where to turn.
Is part of the first step here to start destigmatizing a lot of this? Because you say addiction, and that sounds like somebody has just got this deep, dark, evil, ugly secret. And yet, you know, when we start to look at some of these definitions, we begin to realize that this is more widespread and more common than we realize.
I think one of the places the church can start is to really have an honest discussion about the difference between guilt and shame. And we like to say, you know, guilt is when I feel bad about what I did, but shame is when I feel bad about who I am. Now, if we believe what St. Paul wrote, as you said, that we are new creations in Christ, we are not bad. We are good people who are struggling sometimes with some bad things. And so separating identity from behavior is very helpful in destigmatizing addiction. So saying to the person, you know, you might even want to say you're a person with addiction. I work with people who they can't handle that label of addict because it's too self-defeating for them. Other people are okay with it. You know, say, well, you're a person with alcoholism. You're a person whose drinking has taken over. Separating the behavior from actually who the person is what the church can help with in terms of the spiritual healing process.
Sometimes, of course, the big challenge here is just coming to grips with the face of who we really are. You know, there's that mask that I think we not only put on in front of others, but sometimes even that mask is apparent in the mirror, isn't it? We can kind of fool ourselves.
Well, we like denial, and I think it's human nature. I think it's the ego. I think it's the sin nature of the flesh or whatever you want to call it. We like to think that we're doing okay, and sometimes it's hard to take an honest look in the mirror to say to really give an honest inventory of how I really am doing.
Let's flip a caller or two here real quick before the end of our conversation. We're going to jump over to Oakland and say good evening to Eleanor. Eleanor, come on in with your comment or question for Jonathan Benz.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen. And first, I'd like to say I really am thankful that you're having this conversation. I just have a comment and maybe a little bit of a question. My comment is that several years ago, I started a substance abuse recovery ministry in my church. But first, before we actually got the group started, we actually partnered with our local mental health association, and we actually got professionals to come in and give us an overview about the pharmacology of addiction as well as the sociology of addiction. Once we got that information, I was able to talk with my pastor, get him on board with it, and actually the members of our recovery group came basically right out of our congregation. As we began to do it more and more and months passed by, we were able to even invite some of the family members of people who were in recovery. And we also used Bible, and we also used prayer, and just a number of different things. So how do you think about churches partnering with other churches and partnering with other community mental health associations?
Some really good questions, and it sounds like you're doing some really good work there, too. Jonathan, what do you think?
Eleanor, I love it. Yes, yes, and yes. That was a great approach, well done in partnering and bringing in good information to the congregation and also working with your pastor. You know, oftentimes we don't deal with things in our churches until there's a felt need. So when there's a crisis, we then respond. And so including the leadership and saying, hey, you know, we're not a silo here. We're not a reservoir. We're a river. And we're going to allow the information and the healing to flow. And sometimes we got to partner with other people to provide optimal healing for our parishioners.
And, you know, there's so many organizations out there that you can partner with that you don't have to sort of do all the heavy lifting and, you know, reinvent the wheels, so to speak. More and more churches, for example, are discovering the ministry of Celebrate Recovery. And that has been exploding, perhaps not as fast as we'd love to see, but that's been exploding across the country. So this idea of whether you're partnering with another congregation or taking advantage of some of the resources, as Eleanor just mentioned, that already exist to say, hey, what can we do to be more effective in our local ministry? And I love the fact that they recognize, gee, we've got some folks right here in our congregation that are already struggling.
Thank you.
We appreciate the call tonight, Eleanor. Jonathan, I know we've just kind of scratched the surface here this evening, but for others out there that are eavesdropping on the conversation, heard what you've had to share, heard what the caller just had to share, where would you recommend they take some important first steps?
Well, I think we have to ask. Now, I always tell people, be careful who you tell your story to. Not everyone has earned the right to hear your story. So when you go for help, make sure that you're going to someone who you are somewhat confident that they can help point you in the right direction if they don't have the answers themselves. So hopefully your pastor or an elder in the congregation or a lay leader or a therapist or someone in the community, but first you have to ask. And that's what we all have to do. When we're recognizing that we have a problem, we have to ask for help. If we don't ask for help, we'll never get the help that we need, that we so desperately need.
And, of course, in terms of resources, I mentioned Celebrate Recovery, and also a copy of Jonathan's new book might be very helpful to you, too. It's called The Recovery-Minded Church, Loving and Ministering to People with Addiction, newly published by InterVarsity. You can get it on the web, of course, the usual suspects, Amazon.com, local bookstores, and RecoveryPlace.com. That's RecoveryPlace.com. And our thanks to Jonathan Benz for being with us on this segment of Lifeline.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
I got a telephone call on a Saturday evening while enjoying dinner with some friends. It's about probably 6 o'clock. And it was my bank calling my cell phone to say, "Now, Mr. Roberts, we just wanted to touch bases with you. We noticed a couple of out-of-the-ordinary charges on your credit card. And one was for approximately $1,000 at Fry's in San Jose. And the other charge was almost $2,000, $1,700 and change, as I recall, at a Walmart store in Modesto. And what caught their attention was the fact that the two charges fell approximately 15 minutes apart. Now, I don't care if you're traveling on a Learjet. San Jose to Modesto in 15 minutes just simply isn't possible. Well, their suspicions were correct, and my worst fears had been realized. My credit card information had been compromised, and at least two people were running around the state of California with my credit card number just picking up all kinds of goodies at electronic stores. Well, the good news is we shut down the card immediately. We were able to fend off any further illicit charges against the card. And while a bit chagrined, it got no worse than that. For literally tens of thousands of Americans, though, the story of identity theft doesn't end there. In fact, it begins there and gets much worse, as it did for my next guest tonight, who's taken the time to help share his horrific story with the rest of us, and hoping that you can learn from some of the do's and don'ts and understand what you need to do once you've either discover that your identity has been compromised, or better yet, steps to take to help negate or reduce the possibility of that happening. Scott Merritt has written a new book called Simply Identity Theft: Recovery is Possible. Scott, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Your story is a bit unusual in the sense that you first learned of this, well, much like I did. Your bank had contacted you by a letter indicating that, probably not unlike the 70 million people who got compromised over at Target, that there had been some kind of a breach of data with relationship to accounts there at the bank where you did business. Though when you went and looked into all of this initially, you discovered that you weren't one of them. Nothing amiss had occurred, but that was kind of a real false sense of security for a short moment, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Tell us more what happened.
Well, what happened, a couple months down the road, I checked my statement, and again, I didn't see anything, so wasn't too alarmed. But then about 3 months down the road, I started having all kinds of overdrawn accounts, checks bouncing, credit cards being opened in my name, and I got hit really hard because not only did I have personal accounts at that institution, but corporate accounts.
So this went
really hard really quickly.
This went beyond simply somebody copied or got their hands on your credit card information and started charging against you. In fact, is it fair to describe this as saying that suddenly there were two Scott Merritts running about with the same or held in common the same credit identity, and unfortunately the bad version of Scott Merritt was causing all kinds of problems for the good version?
That would be a mild way of putting it, but it's more like 8 or 10 Scott Merritts running.
Really?
Around.
What happens in a case like that? Is this information, once it has been compromised because somebody's managed to hack their way into a banking computer or through the computers at Target or whatever, and gather enough personal information to be able to go out there and start opening up accounts in your name, do they sell this information off? Is that how it's getting to be to multiple persons, individuals?
That is exactly what happens. A lot of times, like with the Target situation, what probably will happen with a lot of those people is the actual fraudsters will sell those names and phone numbers and account numbers off to other people, and they'll take their cash and run, and then they'll take the people who buy that information will take it and multiply the problem.
And that problem can get multiplied not only across the state, but across continents too, can't it?
That is exactly. At one point in my process, I actually had someone from the UK call me.
Oh.
So.
And
that one was obviously very easy to identify, given it was on another continent.
Now, some people listening to this would say, well, Scott, you were notified initially by your bank that there was a breach of data. You watched it over a couple of months, no suspicious activity, then all of a sudden all kinds of suspicious activity. Why couldn't you simply go back to the bank and say, hey, look, the letter that you sent me is demonstrating that, yep, now I in fact am a victim of all of this, so let's shut everything down and stop these criminals in their tracks.
Well, and that would be a logical thing if we were dealing with a credit card. When you deal with a Visa debit card tied to your checking account, you do not have the same protections that you would have if we were dealing with a national credit card. Once it's tied to your checking account, some of the safeguards are not there, and that therein lies the problem. Now, the bank, the first couple times, they might eat the charges and say thank you for banking with us, but if it happens repeatedly like it did with me, or in an excessive amount, eventually they're going to stick you with the bill, which is what happened to me.
Well, in your case, it was not only also sticking you with the bill because of repeated activity, but as you suggested, this was activity across multiple layers. I mean, did these people go around and start buying cars in your name, opening up checking accounts in your name, and credit cards and so forth everywhere?
Well, what they did is they started using both personal and corporate cards, credit cards, and opening credit cards and what have you. They cleaned out four of my checking accounts. I ended up with overdrawn fees because I had actually written checks out for my own use. So I then had to go make them right. When the corporate accounts were hit, I actually had to go in and make my partners whole. So it got ugly very quickly. I mean, it was whatever number you have in your mind, triple it, and then you have a fathomable. Because I'm a financial guy by trade, because I'm in the securities business. And so when you manage millions, you become a target.
So when we think that, well, if anything like that untoward happens, I'm simply going to call the bank. The bank will shut down my credit card. They will issue me a new one, or they will shut down my ATM card, issue me a new one, open up a new account number. Everything will be hunky-dory. That wasn't at all your experience, was it?
Absolutely, it was not. In fact, what I would encourage everyone to do, if it happens, first of all, number one is do not use the Visa debit card tied to your checking account. I know they're convenient, but every time you use that, you're opening up your checking account to fraudsters. And that what that does is, once that's happened once or twice, it will happen over and over and over because people will sell that information.
Well, what if they say, well, wait a minute now, Scott, though I have a PIN number attached to that, and it's a pretty crafty number. No one knows my birth date, so how could they ever compromise my PIN?
Well, because what they actually have is they have predictive dialers, and they can actually figure out what your PIN is. No matter how creative you think you are, I guarantee you they can figure that out. That's one of the reasons why most of the European market has went to a chip system to prevent that very thing.
And, of course, the irony is when you go to a store and you make a point-of-sale purchase with your debit card, you have to enter your PIN number to authorize that charge, and it's going out over that retailer's wires. Although it might ultimately be connected back to your bank, it's still going through some third party that potentially could capture that data, couldn't it?
That is exactly what's happening, and that is what's happening. That transition between the retailer and the credit card processor, that is what's happened to companies like Target and Neiman Marcus and these other guys, that is exactly what happened. In my case, someone actually broke into a brick-and-mortar building and got my information. However, obviously, in the case of Neiman Marcus and those guys, someone actually stole that information out of the air.
And this is extreme risk for anybody that has any decent level of credit, isn't it? Because if you got a little bit of money in the bank, or you've been dutiful in paying your bills on time, and you've got a credit score, you know, in the upper sevens, you're the ideal target, aren't you? You are the person that these thieves want to be able to not only get their hands on any of your liquid assets that they can drain from your accounts, but then steal your identity and turn around and start opening up credit cards and charging those to the max as well. So it really comes down to the better disciplined you are at your finances, the higher risk you have. Is that true?
To some degree. However, how you can manage that situation, it comes down to one word, and the word is identity. And I know this is going to sound peculiar, but you want to make sure that your name and your address and your phone number that you use on all financial matters matches identically the way it appears on your Social Security card, on your driver's license, on your bank statement, on your credit card statement. And I mean remedial, if, for example, on your driver's license you have a middle initial, but on your Social Security card you don't, you need to change one of them so that they match. Same thing with your bank account. If your name appears one way and on another credit card statement it appears another way, that's an opportunity for fraud. Same thing with address. Let's say your address has the word road in it, and in one instance you spell the word road out, another one you put RD period. Again, that's a breeding grounds for fraud.
How do they use that? How are they able to manipulate those subtle differences? Because as you were talking, I opened my wallet here, and I notice I have a few credit cards that's just my first and last name, and I've got some credit cards that has my middle and issue, and other credit cards that spells both my middle spells my middle name out entirely.
Right, and so what that does is that creates aliases on your credit report, so when someone submits an application in any variation or something even similar to any one of those three variations you just named, that's an opportunity for fraud.
Wow.
And how you can clean that up is getting it so everything matches. You start with your state IDs, your driver's license, your Social Security card, professional licenses, etc. Then you take those, photocopy them, and submit them to your creditors so they change your account so they appear the same.
We're going to pause for a minute. We've got more great insights from Scott Merritt. Scott was a victim of identity theft back in 2005, 2006, and literally ruinous to both his personal private credit as well as his business credit. And it's taken him years to unravel this mess. In fact, even as we sit out here, what has it been now? 8 years almost, he's still dealing with the aftermath of all of this. 8 years later. If you ever shopped at a Target store around Christmas time, you could potentially yet be a victim of all of this. 70 million credit cards were compromised. And as Scott suggests, it's pretty easy for them to gather enough information on you to be able to recreate your identity. The thought of two Craig Roberts running around out there is just too much for the world to handle. So how do you go about reducing some of that risk? We'll talk about that and then more steps on what to do once you've unwittingly become a victim of identity theft. Back to more of our conversation with Scott Merritt as Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
What are the biggest mistakes that people make when they try to address a breach of data or outright identity theft is to assume that your local banking institution is your friend, they're here to help, they will cut the thief off at the pass and make it all well again. But in fact, there's not much motivation, shockingly, for banks to address this problem. That certainly seemed to be your experience. It looks like they did little, if anything, but to exacerbate this horrific situation unfolding before you. Why was that?
Well, and it's because eventually they didn't want to be on the hook for the expenses, and it comes down to money. Banks make money by loaning money, not by dealing with fraud and things of that nature. And that's why it is critical, when you are aware of that situation, you go into the bank and file an affidavit. They are not going to want to file it, but make them file it anyway. And make sure you get a copy of it, and then go file a police report.
It's going to be important, Scott, to also file that police report?
Yes, and I will tell you from my own experience that filing the police report, because cops and police officers really don't like taking these reports, it took me 90 days for me to finally get my police report filed, because everybody's saying, oh, we don't handle those. But your local sheriff's office will handle them, but they're not going to want to handle it, just so you're aware.
Scott Merritt is with us today. The book is Identity Theft, Recovery is Possible. We're talking about the do's and don'ts, what you need to know if it happens, and also share some insights on how to reduce the possibility of being a victim of identity theft. Though I would imagine in this day and age, Scott, the idea of totally inoculating yourself from this, is that kind of a pipe dream? I mean, given all that Edward Snowden unveiled and what NSA is doing, including eavesdropping on our conversation right now, is this notion of pure 100% protection, is that just a pipe dream?
Yeah, I would say it's a pipe dream. However, there are some steps you can take that will minimize and greatly reduce your risk. And the number one thing I would say is, again, do not use your Visa debit card tied to your checking account. You want to use a national bank credit card. That doesn't mean that your local bank doesn't have a national bank credit card. A lot of times, the local smaller banks will partner with a national bank to offer a credit card that is national in nature. And how you'll know it's a national bank credit card, you may not qualify for this limit, but you call your bank and you ask them, what is the largest limit this card is able to be in size? And if they say it's $50,000 or more, that's a national card.
So you don't want them, the thieves, in other words, to have access to your debit card, which, you know, a lot of us go into Starbucks, boom, we present the card. It's like a $3 or $4 charge. I don't want to have to deal with that on a credit card and then, you know, write a check to pay it at the end of the month. So a lot of folks just say, hey, I'm going to take this and treat the thing like a substitute for cash. That's a real risk you're suggesting.
And if they want to do that, there is a way you can do that. There are what's called reloadable Visa debit cards. You can go and put X amount of dollars on that card and then use it. And when it's used up, just throw it away and go get you another one. There are a lot of retailers that offer them. A lot of your smaller community banks offer those reloadable cards. I know a lot of your retailers, like Walmart, for example, I know offers those.
How bad did this get for you? I mean, you talked about them having access to both your personal identity as well as your business credit worthiness. I know there was an extreme impact there at both levels, but did I read right in the book that this got so bad that at one point you, in fact, had been, they had put out a felony arrest warrant for you?
And that actually happened twice. I was actually stopped at an international airport. I was also stopped. I got pulled over on an expressway and had the same thing happen. I had to go to the police station and all of that. It was easy for me to prove that it wasn't me because I am securities licensed. My prints were on file, and obviously they didn't match the felony record print. So therefore, it was very easy for me to prove. At that point, I then had to get the FBI, Secret Service, and Department of Justice involved, and my U.S. congressman, and they had to go in and scrub everything up and send me letters so that if it happened again, I didn't have to go through the whole ordeal all over again.
This sounds like it becomes a full-time job just trying to piece your life back together again.
It can, but again, if you one of the things that I learned the hard way was if I would have had some of the things that I was talking about, having different variations of your name, not present, using the right kind of cards, not Visa debit cards, because I used to do the same thing everybody else does. Some of those things would have greatly missed it. And the other thing is there's an extreme process to follow, and if you make one little mistake, you have to start the process over. And there is no roadmap to help you with that process. That's really why I wrote the book, is I give everybody the roadmap so that you know how to do it, when to do it, how to prepare it, how to send it, so that you don't end up restarting the process over and over and over.
This is really a book that, you know, in some cases people go out and they buy a book because they've gone through this terrible experience and now they're trying to get some insights from somebody who's been down the road. This is almost a book that ought to be bought ahead of time, isn't it?
It is, and again, even if you haven't been an identity theft victim, if you read the book ahead of time, you can prevent it so that you're not a victim. And in the book, in one of the chapters, I even tell you how to structure your credit in such a fashion with little details of how your name appears, how your address appears. You can actually improve your credit score with those little techniques.
Scott Merritt is with us tonight in this segment of the program. We're talking about identity theft. It impacts literally hundreds of thousands of Americans every year. Most recently, we've heard news of a breach of information that took place impacting 70 million credit cards at Target. Neiman Marcus, 40 million, 110 million credit cards out there floating around that are being sold on the black market amongst criminals. And you know what? Some of the names on those credit cards might be yours. So what do you do about it? We're going to talk more about this. We'll also find out from Scott, how helpful were the credit reporting agencies? I mean, after all, they're kind of in the thick of all of this. How helpful were outfits like Equifax or TransUnion in helping them to unravel this disaster and get his financial life back on track again? We'll find out that and more as this edition of Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
The book is called Identity Theft. Its author, who's been down this road, unfortunately, himself, Scott Merritt, sharing some insights on what to do if it happens to you, and most importantly, perhaps, preventative steps in order to reduce the risk of becoming a victim of identity theft. Understand that trying to unravel this mess, Scott, is often like, well, it's been equated to like trying to get your name off the TSA no-fly list, if in fact you've been erroneously placed there. What kind of support, if all, did you receive from any of the big three credit reporting agencies? Were Experian, TransUnion, Equifax, were they very helpful in trying to kind of unravel this spaghetti tangle that your financial life became?
In the beginning, I would say no, but what happened eventually, once I was able to get the police report filed and I got some of the dispute letters done by attorneys and different organizations that helped me along the way, that I, by trial and error, once I kind of began to build the initial file, I was then able to go to my U.S. congressman, and he was able to exert some pressure on Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian and get them to assist me. And I would point out, in particular, what Equifax did is they actually assigned me a liaison that liaised between Equifax and my congressman, and they were able to get the stuff off. Though it would frequently reappear, they were able to get the bulk of it off in about 6 months.
And let me stop you there, because I remember reading in the book, you talked in one chapter about how you had to get a letter written, and an attorney wound up soaking you for $375.
Yep.
People are saying, wait a minute now, if I've gone through this, I've had my accounts have been breached, I am now fighting with the bank trying to get monies restored to my accounts, I have to go out and spend money on an attorney to unravel this, and worst yet, you had to deal with your congressman to get help?
Yep. And it's a process, and that's why I wrote the book, because there's no rhyme or reason. Everybody in the process charges a fee, with the exception of the congressman. And so they're all in it for them. They're not.
If you
succeed in the process, they're happy, but that's really not why they're there.
And at the end of the day, even the congressman charges a fee. I believe they collect it every April 15th. Scott, so it sounds to me like this is a road that if you can at all avoid going down, you really want to avoid going down it. Spend the last few moments of our time together tonight. And again, I'm going to urge folks, this is really a book you need to get your hands on so you can get better prepared, because you don't want to have to go out and try to find the book after it's happened. You want to know what to do if it happens, on how to quickly react, and most importantly, some of the steps you can take to help reduce your risk going out the gate. And so these are kind of the homework assignment for all of us tonight is, number one, consistency in the way your name is written, the way you're literally down to the letter of the way your address is on bills. So if I have a credit card statement that comes in from Citibank and another one that comes in from Chase, I want to make sure that they're both billing me at Street, spelled S-R- it spelled out as opposed to just abbreviated. Is that correct?
Yeah, whatever way you have it appearing in one place, that's the way it needs to appear in all places. And the most common way to do it is how it appears on your driver's license is how you typically have it appear in every place else. Now, if for whatever reason it's spelled out on all of your documents and your driver's license is wrong, there is a one-page form that you can get at DMV and submit that. And again, of course, the state's going to charge you $5, but they'll fix it for it.
All right. Walk me through, if there was a top 10 list you had to do of some of the things that everybody listening right now ought to do to be proactive to reduce their risk, and some you've already mentioned, kind of walk us through what that list might look like.
Well, again, obviously making sure your name and your address is correct. Again, making sure you use the same phone number. Secondly is make a photocopy of every single thing in your wallet, front and back, and staple it in the order that it appears, because you'll need that for the police report. That way it's already done. If you're going to go and apply for credit and you have to use your Social Security card, photocopy it and then put your Social Security card back in your strong box or your safe. Do not carry it around in your wallet. Those are some of the obvious ones. But then, again, if you're going to make purchases out in the public, do not use the Visa debit card. Use a national credit card. And I would recommend you put the majority of your bills on that credit card with the exception of your mortgage. And then what you do is periodically just go in and use your bill pay service at your local bank and to pay your credit card, because then that transaction is actually insured. So that way you're minimizing the way the only people who have access to your checking account is your credit card company.
Yeah, you know, we've heard that mail theft, for example, here in the Bay Area in a number of communities in the last several months, mail theft has been on the rise, both stuff that's coming in and things that are going out. You'll see, in fact, I got a neighbor, take a clothespin and will hang bills that he's paying on the lip of the mailbox, expecting the mailman to come and pick those up and take them to the post office as he's delivering mail. Isn't that an easy way also to steal those checks and wash them and rewrite them?
Well, not only that, but what you've basically done when they do that, they now have your routing number, they have your checking account number, they have your name, they have your address, and how you sign your name.
No. We're literally giving away a lot of this, aren't we? I mean, people that use birthdays as passwords. In fact, there's a list that comes out every once in a while of the top 10 most popular passwords, password being one of them. There are many degrees in which we're kind of setting ourselves up for this, aren't we?
You are, and that's why on my website at scottamerritt.com, what I actually have is I have a free quiz that you can take. And it will actually tell you the different elements of your identity and your credit profile that are at risk that you need to deal with. And that will kind of tell you how much of a problem you're going to have or could have down the road. Because you're really playing Russian roulette. It's not a matter of if it will happen, it's a matter of when it will happen. And obviously, as you can see, it's happening more and more often. And that's why you got to make sure you're protected. The other thing that I would recommend everybody, if they don't want to put a lot of money on their credit card, they can go get one of those reloadable credit cards, put a couple $100 on it, use that to make your purchases at the coffee shop and wherever, and then when it's done, you throw it away and go get you another one. Yeah, that's going to cost you a buck or two every time you got to do that, but it's cheaper than dealing with what I had to deal with.
What about these so-called identity protection services that are out there? Are they of any value?
They definitely play a role, and there are different levels of those. There are ones where you can simply monitor your credit report, and again, I use one of them, and the reason why I do that is because I can get notified anytime someone applies for an application in my name. It also lets me know if there are any variations of my name, address, because, again, you can get those with all three credit bureaus, and so you can see how it appears in each location and each creditor.
Is scrutinization of your monthly banking statement and credit card statements also important? I know that in a case once years ago, somebody had lifted a credit card number from me, and what caught my attention was there were one or two charges on my following month's credit card statement. statement for like $1.64. And I thought, now, I complain about people at the grocery store who buy $5 worth of groceries and they pick up a can of Coke and a package of potato chips and they whip out a credit card to pay with it as opposed to cash. And so when I saw this tiny little charge, I thought, well, that's odd. And of course, by the following month, that little odd item had turned out to be thousands of dollars in erroneous fraudulent charges. Do we need to be careful about that too?
Yes, you do. You need to, and that, again, that's why if you use a national card, when you become aware of those, you can call your credit card company, notify them, and they will take the charge off, and they will simply send you a form. You sign it, send it back, and your role is done. That's the advantage of using a national credit card over using your Visa debit card. With the Visa debit card, your risk is unlimited. You could literally be on the hook for every single dime, where with the credit card, the most you can be out is $50.
Well, and the other thing, too, to point out is, if there's fraudulent charges against your credit card, they've gotten a hold of your credit card. They haven't gotten a hold of your money. If they manage to go in and vacuum out all the cash out of your account, you're now at the mercy, and some states have laws that work toward protecting you. But, if the $1,000 balance that was in there on Tuesday has been dropped to zero and you're bouncing checks now all over town, you're still at somebody's mercy to restore that cash to you. The reality is that cash is gone. And in some cases, as you suggest, the banks are hesitant, if at all, to ever restore that money.
Right. But again, if you use the credit card, you avoid all of that hassle because, for lack of a term, it's kind of almost like an insurance policy. And I hate to use that term loosely, but the reality is there are fraud protections that were implemented during the credit crunch back a few years ago, and they really tightened up the protections for the credit card. Unfortunately, they left the loop open for the Visa debit cards tied to the checking account. And that's why in my book I spend a whole chapter on dealing with those very things. And again, if you go to scottamerritt.com, in my book, Identities Have Do's and Don'ts, I not only give you the process, but I actually give you the letters to use, so that all you got to do is literally retype those letters with your name, your address, a copy of your driver's license, Social Security card, and where to send it, how to send it, and then how to track it to find out when you need to send the next letter. And in Michigan and the other states, under federal law, if they don't respond within 30 days, it has to be deleted without exception.
Wow. So some really solid advice all the way around inside the pages of Identity Theft. And as Scott mentioned, you can get a copy of the book and also take that complimentary test at his website at Scott A. Merritt. Think of Merritt like Lake Merritt, scottamerritt.com. And we are so appreciative of Scott and sharing, Scott, from your pain and bitter experience of what happened as you were a victim of identity theft, to help the rest of us from hopefully never going down that road. Identity theft recovery is possible. Do's and don'ts, what you need to know, what you need to do. Details on the web at scottamerritt.com. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of Lifeline. Thanks so much for being with us. And if there was anything you heard on today's show that you'd like to hear again or share with a friend, grab a copy of the Lifeline podcast. Simply log on to KFAX.com. That's KFAX.com for the Lifeline podcast. Our producer is Wanda Sanchez. I'm Craig Roberts. Till next time round, remember, just don't keep the faith. Get out there and share it and make it a great evening. So long.
Opinions expressed in the preceding program do not necessarily represent the views of the ownership, staff, or management of KFAX. Copyright Salem Communications, all rights reserved.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.